WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, Willie Dixon, Bo Diddley, Etta James, Little Walter are just some of the blues and rhythm and blues stars who recorded for Chess Records. Chess was based in Chicago and played a prominent role in recording the new urban and electrified blues of the 1950s. These records were particularly influential to British blues aficionados like the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, Cream, and Led Zeppelin. These bands covered and wrote songs inspired by the Chess recordings, and that led many young American listeners to discover the older blues performers who were part of the roots of rock and roll. Chess also recorded one of the first great rock and roll records by Chuck Berry.
Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true? You done started doing the things you used to do. As I was motivating over the hill, I saw Maybelline in a coupe de ville. A Cadillac rolling on an open road, nothing out to run my V8 Ford. A Cadillac doing about 95, moves bumper to bumper, rolling side to side. Maybelline, why can't you be true?
That song was recorded and named by Leonard Chess, who owned Chess Records with his brother Phil. My guest Nadine Cahotas has written a new book called Spinning Blues into Gold, The Chess Brothers and the Legendary Chess Records. It tells the story of how two Polish-Jewish immigrants moved to Chicago and created a legacy of great blues recordings. The brothers sold the label in 1969. Leonard died soon after. Phil is retired. Their son Marshall runs their music publishing company. I asked Cahotas about the Chess family after it came to Chicago in 1928, when Leonard and Phil were boys.
It was a scrappy kind of existence. Their father was very determined, and he opened a junk shop, as did many other immigrants from Eastern Europe. There were something like 40, 50, 60 junk shop listings in the Yellow Pages in Chicago in the time we're talking about, the late 30s and 40s. So they got used to being in that community and were making some kind of living. And Leonard had never really wanted to be in the junk business at all. And he found an opportunity to open his first liquor store in the heart of the Black Belt at 5060 South State Street. So in my own mind, I've attributed it to circumstance plus determination and the instinct for an opportunity.
So from liquor stores, the Chess Brothers moved into a club, the Macomba, and then got into records. First, Leonard Chess became a partner in Aristocrat Records, and then when his partner in that company left, Leonard's brother Philip got involved with the company, and then they changed the name to Chess Records.
Yes, that's right. I just was going to say one thing. It's really rather a delicious story about how Leonard got into Aristocrat Records, in that the founding of Aristocrat, a remarkable woman in her 20s, a woman named Evelyn Aaron, who had the moxie to decide to go into the record business, raised some of her own money with a couple of friends and put out a few records. And because of the small community of people doing a certain kind of music on the south side of Chicago, Leonard knew who she was and vice versa, and he decided to take a chance and try to record someone who was singing in his club. And I just found that most fascinating. There were not very many women back then who were in the record business at all.
You say that it was Muddy Waters who made Leonard Chess see a possible future in music. How did they meet?
They met when Muddy was asked to come and do a session through his friend Sonny Land Slim, who was a piano player. And Leonard almost missed the boat, if I can use that term, in the first instance, when he heard him singing his very haunting and now a famous "I Can't Be Satisfied and I Feel Like Going Home." He really couldn't understand what Muddy was saying, and he said, "What's he saying? What's he saying?" He could not really see that there might be a market for that, because it was quite different from the music that he had been hearing in his own club, which was jump blues with saxophone players and different kind of bass being played and different kind of piano. And this was something different. So that is how they met.
Why don't we hear I Can't Be Satisfied, Muddy Waters, okay. 1948 recording.
Child, don't you want to go? Woman, I'm trouble. I be all good now. Well, babe, I just can't be satisfied, and I just can't keep on. Well, I feel like snapping pistol in your face. I'm gonna let some graveyard Lord be her resting. Woman, I'm trouble, I be all wood mine. Well, baby, I can never be satisfied, and I just can't keep on.
That's Muddy Waters on electric guitar and vocals. He also wrote the song I Can't Be Satisfied, recorded for Leonard Chess in 1948. I think part of the story of Chess Records is what it was like to sell records if you were making rhythm and blues or blues records in the late 40s and the 1950s. Leonard Chess was really very good at selling records. First of all, what was he up against selling rhythm and blues records or blues records, what was known then as race records? What was the differences between selling that and selling recordings by white performers?
I think one of the obvious answers is a much smaller market, because you have a much smaller potential to read that market. There was very little radio play for race records, for black music, when the Chess Brothers and the other independent record labels like King and Savoy and Modern out in California got started. The bulk of their trade was really jukeboxes in taverns and shops and that sort of thing. You simply had to get out on the road thousands of miles, days and days and days, with your car full of records to drop off to every distributor, every disc jockey, to try to see if you could interest them in playing the music. It was difficult, but out of that came what I came to believe was kind of like a fraternity of people who knew one another. They would run into one another on the road. There's one moment, for example, where another record producer named Leah Gelnick ran into Leonard. They had the same itinerary, so they traveled together. They were plenty competitive and cutthroat in a certain way, but yet there was this sense of a shared mission.
What would Leonard Chess do to sweeten it for DJs, to inspire DJs to play his records?
I think the sweetening came in a couple of forms. First of all, there was giving them the free records to play, and then what people used to talk about as the $50 handshake. It may not always have been $50. It may have been the $10 or the $25 handshake. And of course, we came later to know of it as payola. The other thing was sometimes giving a writing credit to a disc jockey as a way of securing some future money. If the record took off, which they would have a hand in helping make happen, then as a writer, that individual would be entitled to some publishing royalties. One of the difficult things to sort out in working on this was how those transactions actually worked on the ground. Leonard is not here to talk to us about it. But when I talked to Phil about sometimes seeing a writing credit, his memory was that sometimes that was done with consent. I use that term in the broad sense. That is to say, look, we'll give you $100 right now, and this guy's name is going to go on the record, and everybody's betting against the future. It's very difficult if you weren't in the same room. One of the things I think that is not contestable is that these were very rarely meetings between peers. You're an artist, you're struggling, you want to get a record out. Here's the producer who's going to put the record on the label for you. You don't really have a terrific bargaining position. You're in there, they say, look, we got to do it right now or we're not going to do it. And you say, okay, I'll take the $100. The guy's name goes on the record. Later, if it becomes a million seller, you have to share those royalties.
My guest is Nadine Cahotas, author of a new book about the blues and rhythm and blues label Chess Records. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Nadine Cahotas. She's the author of the new book, Spinning Blues into Gold, The Chess Brothers and the Legendary Chess Records. Let's talk a little bit about Willie Dixon and his importance to Chess Records. He was a bass player, a songwriter. He arranged and produced a lot of the sessions at Chess. Some of the songs he wrote include Backdoor Man and Little Red Rooster, which the Rolling Stones covered, Spoonful, which Cream covered, You Shook Me, which Led Zeppelin did, and You Need Love, which Led Zeppelin borrowed heavily from for their song Whole Lotta Love. Tell us a little bit more about Willie Dixon and his place at Chess.
Well, as you said, he produced a lot of sessions. He found talent. He just knew everybody and knew everybody you needed to know to put a session together. And when there was time to go into the recording session, if you couldn't find a musician, Willie Dixon could find that musician and get him into the studio and get things going. Leonard and Phil were not musicians, but they had terrific business instincts, and I think a part of that was knowing what they knew, knowing what they didn't know, and who could help them provide it. So Willie Dixon, in my mind, was one of several people who filled in the large musical gaps of Leonard and Phil in trying to build this company.
Let's hear Helen Wolf singing Spoonful, a song written by Willie Dixon. Willie Dixon is featured on bass. As you point out, Chess Records developed the image of being like a sharecropping system. What did they do to get that image?
I think that what I meant to suggest there, not so much that they were sharecropping, but I guess that it could look like sharecropping. They took care of the musicians, the artists, almost like family. And in one interview that I was able to hear that Phil gave, that was closer to the time of Chess being in existence, the interviewer said, "Well, you almost treated them like family, didn't you?" And he said, "Well, yes, that's what they wanted to be treated like. That is to say, they bought them cars, they handled their rent, they handled their medical bills, and in several cases provided attorneys when they got into legal scrapes. And as I think I said in the book, one kind of record was made, another was kept."
But like Muddy Waters got an Oldsmobile after the success of Hoochie Coochie Man. Did that come out of his royalties, or was that just a gift?
My understanding was that came out of his royalties. Later on, a woman, one of the women singers in the Chess studio, Mitty Collier, got a Bonville, and that was her choice. She could either have cash or she could have the Bonville as payment. But it was not a straight out gift. It was a kind of payment.
Now, Jerry Wexler at Atlantic Records said to you, "We didn't make our artists' car payments, we didn't pay their mortgages, we didn't dress them, we were not lords of the manor." Do you think that a lot of people in the record industry felt that it wasn't a good system that the Chess Brothers were using to pay their artists, that it was patronizing?
I think that's certainly accurate, that that a lot of people felt that. I think that it was an evolution that came from both sides. I think we have to remember that the musicians would come in asking for something and needing to be taken care of, and Leonard and Phil met those needs. From their perspective, they didn't think they were running a charitable institution, and felt that, yes, you're in trouble, we're going to take care of you. We have mutual self-interest here. If you're not available, you can't make a record. You can't make a record. We can't make money. I'm happy to help you, but this is like an advance, and so I am going to note this. One of the issues here is the method of record keeping. You know, how much was advanced, and in what form it was advanced, and was that an appropriate amount of money that was set down? And then alternatively, how many records were sold, and how quickly am I getting up to date? So little documentation, and I think it was unfair to just have the allegations without trying to understand in a larger sense what was going on. If I could just continue here, the one place where I was able to see clearly in black and white on a meticulously kept ledger sheet was a little label in Jackson, Mississippi, Trumpet Records, that was the first home of Sonny Boy Williamson. The late Lillian McMurray kept precise records of every record that was sold, and every time Sonny Boy or the other people who recorded for her came in and asked for a loan. And I believe something like 60 times in the space of a year, Sonny Boy came in and said, "I need money for this. I got to get my instrument out of hock. I have to get the chairs taken care of." There was a poignant letter from Sonny Boy's wife to Mrs. McMurray: "Can you please send Sonny Boy's money to me? Because otherwise, if you don't, I'm not going to get it." And I say this again just to try to give a flavor of the context back then of these relationships between musician and label owner. It was much, indeed, more familial than I think we might realize, but it did have aspects of sharecropping, in that one person kept the books.
You know, the things that you're describing in a way feed into that image that is very popular in aspects of music lore. The image I'm speaking of is that, you know, African-American artists make great recordings while the Jews who owned many of the record labels and clubs exploited them. And there's this, like, black-Jew conflict in a lot of music lore. And I'm wondering how you think the Chess Brothers story fits into that lore, and what you, trying to be fair and objective about that, have to say about it.
Right. Well, it certainly fits into that lore very, very much so. And I came away from this book feeling that it was not that at all, that there were were rich and important relationships between many of the artists and Leonard and Phil Chess. One of the special moments to me was Marshall's bar mitzvah, which was April 17th, 1955, when he turned 13 years old. And I suppose everybody knows what a bar mitzvah is when in the Jewish tradition you reach the age of being an adult in the eyes of the community. And I say the date again, April 17th, 1955. This is a year, less than a year after the Brown v. Board of Education decision from the Supreme Court, which decreed that that segregated schools were per se unconstitutional. And Marshall's Bar Mitzvah was a fully integrated social event, both the service and then a big dinner for everybody at the Morrison Hotel. And I made sure to include a couple of tables as part of the pictures in the book that show the Chess family's cleaning lady and her husband sitting at a table with other Chess relatives. Another table was Ahmet Erdogan and Jerry Wexler from Atlantic, along with a black DJ and his wife. And I found, having done some work previous to this on civil rights issues and Southern political history, this was quite remarkable to me to have a socially integrated dinner in Chicago in April 1955, knowing that there would not have been such a dinner in Jackson, Mississippi, in Mobile, Alabama, in Birmingham. The other thing, when I had a chance to talk with some of the musicians who are still alive, particularly Etta James, both in her own autobiography, and then when we were talking, there is a deep affection that came through to me in talking to these people. Ahmet Jamal, when he said to me, you know, it was like a good marriage. They were good to me. I was good to them. When Muddy Waters gave an interview to the Louisville Defender in, I believe, 1952 or 1953, and he spoke about how important his friendship was with Leonard Chess. So I came away from all of this feeling that the lore was somewhat misplaced, and that these were far more complicated and important relationships going both ways.
My guest is Nadine Kohoutis, author of a new book about the blues and rhythm and blues label Chess Records. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nadine Kohoutis, author of Spinning Blues into Gold, The Chess Brothers and the Legendary Chess Records. There's a story that Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones told that I think added to the legends of the Chess Brothers as exploiting the artists who recorded for them. Why don't you tell what the story was about Muddy Waters?
Yes, the story was that when the Rolling Stones were making one of their visits to the Fame Studio at 2120 South Michigan Avenue, they walked in and saw somebody up on a ladder painting, and one of them said, "Who's that?" And they said, "Oh, that's Muddy Waters." I do not believe that that story is at all true. People who were working there every day, black musicians and producers and white producers and other people, never, ever, ever saw Muddy Waters doing anything like that, nor would Leonard have ever permitted that. Several people said, starting with Marshall, you can discount Marshall if you want, and talk about Billy Davis, who was so critical to the operation. Muddy Waters was terribly important to Chess and a deeply important person to Leonard personally. I don't believe it to be true, but it is a wonderful story and has great political heft and deep, deep lore.
How often did you hear the story that they made Muddy Waters paint the ceiling, and there he was in his overalls on a ladder when the Rolling Stones came in? Did you hear that from a lot of sources? I mean, had the story just kind of like developed legs?
Oh, certainly. Certainly it's in articles about the company. It was in one new book, relatively new book, about Muddy Waters, and it's part of the part of the gossip, part of the chatter, part of the background noise about Chess. One of the first things I heard, others were that he tended bar, that he cut grass, and none of those things was the case.
What's the status of most of the Chess recordings now? Most of them, many of the great ones, have been reissued. Who owns those masters now?
Yes, MCA Universal, if I have that right, MCA is a part of Universal. They own the Chess catalog, and over the last several years, largely due to one of the creative and interested A&R men, that is, interested in this genre of music, Andy McKay, there have been many, many reissues that have served to keep the music alive. Compilations, box sets of the major artists, theme ones like the Soul Years and Rhythm and Roll. So that is where the music is. Arc Music, which is run by Marshall Chess, still owns a great number of the copyrights. That's a separate issue. But the actual session tapes, and there are something like 8,000 of them, reside in this remarkable building in California, which is all of what the Universal Corporation owns, all the other music companies. And there they are. And I think we have to be appreciative that so many were saved and that they have been reissued so that we can keep listening to them.
Nadine Cahotas is the author of Spinning Blues into Gold, The Chess Brothers and the Legendary Chess Records.